Previously threaded FTP servers were difficult to write because threading APIs currently, you don't really have a way to have threads share their own file system context, or threads have their own. Related to this, sort of, is the config syntax we ended up with. It's sort of hierarchical. Had I been thinking, we would have done it in XML and just gotten away with it, but we did. We used some Yak stuff my dad wrote, but it has a nice inheritance between global defaults and virtual defaults and client defaults, and you can have client authentication methods modify the client stuff and all this gunk. But so we have this nice concept of virtual and client abstraction, which is cool. There's a dedicated site exec thread that does site exec. Cover that in a bit. And there's a listening thread. So as the server is running, there's going to be at least three, right? There's these two, and then the one for at least your minimum virtual. We could have had, and there's an optimization to be made where we have pools of threads waiting around to catch new connections. But in FTP, that isn't really a problem. It's having lots of connections open at a time that kills the machine rather than connection churn, and that's all having pools of threads available gets around. Oh, here we have the graph, right? So it's rather simplistic. We have, on the left is the number of pages in use in the system. The lower one there is Hoser, and that's Woo. This just shows, as the clients connect, you know, Hoser's using the 24K or whatever, and Woo isn't. It was done in a tremendously huge box, so it wasn't too big a problem, but, you know, if you're CDROM.com and you have 10,000 connected clients, that starts to suck really fast. Go for it. Okay, so part of the talk is telling you guys about, you know, the classic stuff we were doing. As we're re-implementing the server, we're looking at how people have done it traditionally and wondering what they were thinking and doing it in ways that make sense now. Most of the servers out there, with ProFTPD being a really strange exception, just read the data and write it back out. It's portable. They want to run across 87,000 Unixes that don't have MMAP semantics, you know, stuff like that. So there's overhead in doing that, of course. You have data local to the process that's reading it in. You have the memory copying going from kernel to user and then writing it back out and doing this whole dance you don't need to do. So the send file system call was one of the things that had happened that prompted us to do the server. So send file, if you guys aren't familiar with it, it's like the write system call, except you go from a file descriptor to a descriptor. You don't have to have local memory image of what you're sending. So you just say, send from this file descriptor this many bytes at this offset, and go for it. And the kernel, you know, reads it in from the socket or file or whatever it happens to be and writes it back out. This is good because we don't have to have an image of the data. We don't have to have read it in, and we don't have to have used mmap. You can use mmap and write rather than read and write, because mmap, you won't actually have to move the data to you before sending it back out. You just have a reference that the kernel will understand. But getting that reference is expensive. You have to, you know, mess with your page tables, and you have to do TLB flushes on SMP and all this stuff so that all the threads who are sharing a VM context have a up-to-date image of the mmap you just did. With sendfile, you don't need that because you don't care what the data is. You just want it to go out the socket. So it's a lot more efficient. So we use that all over the place, transfers, tar generation, LS, all sorts of stuff. It kind of a silly thing, but we did ASCII the right way, if you can, because it's a nightmare. But yeah, in the spec, read through and see how they tell you to continue doing an uploaded ASCII transfer that was terminated while you're in the middle of adding a new line. It's not in there, and no one does it right. It's awesome. But so, there. Yes, usually, like Woo and Pro, at least, for the ones I looked at, they read in a byte, and if it's a new line, they send out a carriage return, and they keep on chugging, which is less than cool. A lot of CPU churn, and you end up writing out these dinky little packets on the network. We just mmap the file in, use the string functions, you know, strtalk, whatever, except not strtalk, because it's bad, but find a new line, and then we write it back out. So we end up doing these nice big scans and then writing the data out, and we don't have the copying overhead. But no one uses ASCII anyway, so it's just kind of silly, but there it is. LS implementation. This is important because a lot of time is spent by the FTP server doing LS work. It's outrageously expensive. So I had an initial one that was really stinky, and Phil fixed most of it when we were up in Ottawa last December. But We try hard not to do lots of memory copying. We have a stat cache. We do all sorts of stuff to minimize the amount of work we do moving from the on-disk representation into something to present to the client. So that's the overview of what we did as we were making the server. We get into more detail here. So here's the LS one. Okay, so most servers, probably aware, they just fork and exec the system's LS because that's a lot easier for them when they have to be running on Dynex and all sorts of garbage. So they just do it that way. The code's easy. But it's really expensive because as you're creating this LS, you create a new process, you load in the LS binary, it walks the disk and does all this junk, and it's very heavyweight. And on top of that, they get the data back to the client by coming from the LS binary through the server to the client. So you have the LS process writes data to the server, it's scheduled, reads the data, writes it to the client, and you get this scheduling ping pong with all this memory copying, and it's not very nice. So a lot of servers did their own internal LS. David Greenman's DGFTPD, which is on cdrom.com, does this. TrollFTPD does, but it's really broken. Peter's PFTPD one is super broken, but so they're all there, and they work, right? But on top of that, LS is just expensive. Even when it's internal, you have to, you know, walk all the metadata, and you have to munge all, you have to create the nice LS output, and you have to burn memory as you're doing this, and it's stinky. So we are awesome. We cache directory listings for full directories. When we have now made this listing and we've sent it off to the client, we store it in a file so we can send it out later. And when we send it out later, it's send file, so you know it's super cool. But the file we store it in is keyed on the dev and inode and ls options, so we have a unique identifier that we can hash and look up to get a new file quickly. We decide the listings are stale when the directory they represent has its M time has changed. And so, of course, when you change certain things in the files in the directory, the M time isn't going to change. So caching dash L output is sort of dangerous if the administrator isn't aware of it. So that's an option. But if you turn it on and know what you're doing, you can just touch the directory when you update files, and it all just works. So if you strace Hoser while it's doing LS work, it ends up being, you know, two stats and a send file. It's very lightweight. That we have previous graphs that I didn't bring that have our LS response time being the x-axis with all the others, you know, going off in various directions. Right, so more little things we did as we're implementing the server. Some strange people like their server to be able to tar things. I argued for about an hour with Willie, but nothing came of it. So we did it. It's only noteworthy because it uses send file to toss out the actual file bits. So when it's generating tar, it's just, you know, diddling this little header piece, sending it, and then doing a send file for the entire data. It makes it very lightweight. Again, you don't have the creating the new process and bouncing around and all that stuff. The site exec thread is kind of neat. Site exec, again, is a really broken concept, but it's expected, so you have to do it. We have, while Hoser's running, say we have 3,000 people connected. That's, you know, 6,000 some odd file descriptors open, and if we don't have send file, we might have mmap files all over the place, and it's just a big scary thing to be forking when we want to do a site exec, because if we'd fork, we'd have to then close all the file descriptors that were opened in the new process before we exec, and so after the kernel's done all this work to create a new image, we then tear it down and exec something. So instead, as the server's starting up, it forks a thread that just deals with site exec work. It sits off in the corner, and its only connection back to the server is through a pipe. So when threads want something site exec, they send a little chunk of data down the pipe that says what they want exec, where it should cheroot, who it should run as, and the socket to send it back out. So this makes the process of site exec much cooler. The other neat piece of this is the having the stood out of the new process be the socket so that we don't have to have it come back through the server. So that the program is just writing right to the client. You know, it's site exec, it's broken, but we do it right. The passive listener thread was the idea of a friend of mine named Joey, who, if you're from Portland, you know Joey. But anyway, he's right guy. So when you're doing passive FTP, the server has to give you a socket to connect to. And usually you have all these distinct processes that may have passives pending, and they'll all have different sockets because they can't share socket space nicely. And that's a pain for the FTP administrator because they want to put their FTP box behind a firewall, but they now have all these passive sockets that want to be coming in through the firewall to these random ports, and it's not very nice. So we have a thread that just listens on this passive socket for all the passive data that's coming in, so you can port forward this back in through your firewall. And you can give it a range of ports to listen on, all that good stuff. The problem here is that due to the incredible awesomeness of the FTP protocol, the only way we can tell what a passive connection or which thread it's for, because all the threads will register themselves, that they'll send the port off to the client, and then they'll register themselves with the listening thread saying, you know, this client's going to connect, here it comes. The only authentication is the source IP of the client that's coming in. So you can't have two passive connections coming in from the same client source IP. It turns out that in the implementation, the thread for the client won't return the passive port until the source IP for the client is free in the list. It's a mess, but it works. Well, it would work if the source was done, but anyway. Right, this is the threading's a big pain in the butt slide. Threading solved the per client state problem easily because the way this is easiest to code, you'll have a single flow of control for each client connection. So you can block as you're sending back to the client, and you can block as you're reading disk, and it's all good because you have one client per execution context, threads in this case rather than processes, but the code's still similar. So that made our lives easier. But because of all this, it made it a huge pain in the butt also. We weren't able to use pthreads because of the threading semantics. We had to have our threads each have their own file system context. Pthreads doesn't allow that. It also doesn't allow each having their own UID and such. So we had to use native clone, and that made glibc very unhappy. But we can get that. And there is the resource keeping problem also, and that's very annoying because we have this massive threaded monster server. Each thread builds up state. There's file descriptors for connected clients. There's memory as they're doing, you know, dir walks, all sorts of random junk. And if that client's to go away, you know, the admin kills the process for the thread, whatever, there's no way for us easily to go back and clean up after the state that thread created. It turns out you have to do lots of per-client bookkeeping. You have to record all the file descriptors you open, all the memory you allocate. It gets to be a pain. And glibc made it even more entertaining because it's only thread-safe when you use pthreads. It uses the pthreads locking primitives to protect against reentrancy because most of the thread safety in glibc is just locking around everything, dlmalloc being the exception. That's in a second. So if you're not using pthreads and you try calling into glibc from two places, stuff explodes all over the place. It wasn't friendly. So, of course, we took the path of every true program and made our own allocator because the main point of contention was dlmalloc, the glibc's memory allocator. It's really nice, but it only gets its memory through break, so you have to lock around that, and it has free lists shared by all the threads, so you have to lock around those pools and all this stuff. There's a whole lot of locking there, and it's a whole lot of broken if you don't have locking. So we made our own allocator just to get around that initially. It's implemented. It's pretty straightforward. We just have, like dlmalloc, we have big pools of memory we allocate from with free lists and everything. But the pool lists, or the pools of memory are gotten via mmap so that we can have multiple threads getting new memory at the same time. Within that bit of memory, we do, you know, quick little pointer math to do quick freeze and allocs because that's basically all we do. If you're in LS, you do a dir walk, you do lots and lots of teeny little allocs and freeze, and that's basically all we do. So it's well engineered for our workload, but would stink for something like Mozilla. But so anyway, we have per thread mmap arenas that the thread allocates from. This ends up being really nice because freeing the state for that client is now just getting rid of that big mmapped arena. When the thread exits, the parent thread that sees it exit, just mmunmaps that area and it's gone. It doesn't have to care about which bits were still allocated and all that. It just works. We're able to do that because we hooked into glibc's. It has hooks for doing all the allocation work. That means stuff within glibc also calls our allocator. That was important because stuff like FTW has allocations inside it that we can't record at all. So if the thread were to die while we were in there, that memory's just gone. This fixed that. There's a cool trick hiding here. The allocation API, of course, is just allocate this bit of memory and return it. There's no way to tell who you are when you're calling it. So our allocator has to figure out what thread to associate this memory with. It was using gitpid initially because all threads have their own PID. But if you looked at strace, we were calling gitpid an outrageous amount. It was quite impressive. You know, x86 was doing like 30,000 system calls a second or something. That was just not cool. So we have this really stinky hack. Rather than calling gitpid, we now allocate all the stacks for the threads on powers of two and cache gitpid at the top of the stack. So when we're in the allocator, to find what thread we are, we just mask the stack pointer, dereference it, and there we are. It's really quick. But of course, we're calling into we're in glibc's hooks, right? So the main thread, who's not the main process, who's not a thread, is also going to have this nasty hack applied, and its stack isn't allocated on a power of two. So we also know that the main process's stack happens to be at OC whatever the hell it is on x86. So this is so not portable. This is not even close. But it ends up being very quick. It was entertaining. That's also the trick that the kernel does, for whatever it's worth, for finding, like when you're calling gitpid, for example, you go into kernel space, and the U area stuff is the same trick. It just masks the kernel stack pointer to find that. So it's not like we made that up. All right, so Hoser's pretty cool, but it still has problems. We can only have 32K clients connected, because there just aren't that many PIDs. We also still have memory overhead per thread because we have a kernel stack and, of course, the thread stack. That's 24K we don't necessarily need, but it's not that big a deal because, I mean, you know, 32K clients is, you know, some odd meg, who cares. The threading model is pretty gross. It's way too reliant on the way Linux does things, simply because everything else is a pain to deal with, so I didn't worry about it. FreeBSD and IRIX both have threading semantics that would be similar, but that we're so tied to how the system implements threads is not cool. IRIX has half thread-safe libraries and half that aren't, and you have two air nodes you have to watch because one's thread-safe and one isn't, and it's scary. So using threads without using something like pthreads ends up being a big pain. So to do it right, we'd want to do a non-blocking version so that we're not tied to having a client per thread. So we're not tied to having file system routines that aren't abstracted. Once we abstract the file system routines, we make them non-blocking, we don't need threads anymore. The world is happy. It's just a lot of coding because we don't have the easy flow per client. We have to be able to notice that we're going to block on something, fall back to an event engine, call back into it later. You end up implementing a scheduler in your FTP server. It's kind of yucky. So that's Hoser. We can ask questions at the very end. I want to get to the web server, and then we'll kind of mash it all together. So the web server, PHHTTPD, which is pointy-haired and pronounced from the Calvin and Hobbes, it was only done to test Steven's SIG.IO event model, really. He got the patches in, and we'll talk about that in a few slides. He got it in, and I needed something that needed I.O. to wrap around it, and a web server sounded cool. So that's where it came from. Its use is very specific. It only serves static files from memory, full stop. You don't have enough memory for your files, you're not serving them. That's all it does. Dynamic content, yeah, whatever. Updating files, you get to restart the server. It's pretty awesome. But it works really well for benchmarks, which is incredibly important. So, we can get to that if you guys want, but... So you give PHHTTPD a list of files when you start up. It does some header precalculation stuff, which is kind of neat and was Alan's idea, of course. We mmap the big file as we come in, and then we allocate headers directly in front of it, preallocate some stuff. So when we're eventually going to be writing back a response, it's in one big chunk. We don't open the file, we don't read it, we just write this pre-allocated thing. And we hash these regions that we've now created on the URL that gets to them. And our URL parsing's crap. You put percents in there, it won't work. You know, links and everything, whatever. But the benchmarks run fast, so. Right, the whole I/O model here, it's all non-blocking. And we'll get to that. But it's driven by real-time SIG I/O queues. And that's a lot of what this talk is about, this piece of the talk. Okay, so we need to talk about the POSIX signal queues. Okay, usually when you get a signal, your process is interrupted and you get to deal with it, right? SIG I/O was a way of having you notified when events happened on sockets, well, on descriptors, but people used it on sockets. The problem with that is that you get a signal delivery and you don't know what's happened. You know one of the sockets you had something happen on it. You have to find out which one with select and some magic, and it was a real pain. If you read Stevens, he rants about it. The only useful implementation he could find for it was an NTP server, which is just goofy. So they fixed that a little. The real-time POSIX queues add the concept of having signal delivery be distinct events rather than a state, right? You don't have a signal pending or not. You have a queue of deliveries that are coming in. And they added the SIG info struct, which is important. It has data about the signal that's being delivered. If it's a usual signal, like, you know, you've killed a process, the SIG info struct will have the PID of the process, the UID, the signal they wanted to send, all this good stuff. Right, these SIG info structs, if you register the signal handler with magic flags, you'll then get a pointer to this. You get the entire struct on the stack. So that's one way of getting it. Or if you've blocked the signal, you'll have it in a kernel managed queue. You'll have these struct SIG infos waiting for you. The contents of SIG info depend on the source of the signal. If it's a process sending it in, if it's the kernel sending it in, if it's a SIG V, you get the address that faulted, all sorts of cool stuff. The signal queues are, it's a kernel managed queue of these incoming SIG infos. So if you haven't blocked the signal but you're currently handling one, it'll be popped in the queue. If you've blocked the signal, all deliveries come into the queue. Each process has its own queue. We need to fix that, but that's how it is now. You can get at this queue by calling SIG wait info. It's like select and pull in that you give it a timeout if there isn't one pending. If there is one pending, you get it back immediately. So go for it. So applying these SIG I/O queues, SIG info queues with SIG I/O is where this gets fun. Stevens patch makes it so SIG I/O delivery from sockets now has this nice stuff that the SIG info struct brings you. If you get a SIG I/O delivery with a real-time signal, you have members of the SIG info struct that say what file descriptor happened, and it encodes the event that happens in, you know, the poll style. So you have hup, error, in, out, all that stuff. Urgent. So with Stevens patch to 2.2.2.3 now, you will get these events on sockets rather than just pipes and all that stuff, because that's already been in there. His work added it so you can tell what event came from socket space to make it. Right, this is more rehashing that you block the signal and then get them queued rather than interrupting your process, which is annoying, because async events bad. So, right. Here's how the web server uses this junk. For all the sockets we carry, we enable SIG I/O delivery because all our work's non-blocking. The engine only churns on work that's created by SIG I/O event delivery. Well, and timers if I did it right. But all the events coming in are only SIG I/O right now. So if there's no work coming in from the sockets from SIG I/O, we just sit there. So we have to get SIG I/O events coming in, and this is how it happens. SIG I/O events on listening sockets are when new connections come in. You'll get a SIG I/O struct that says, you know, this file descriptor got pull in, and you look up in your table that this descriptor is a listening one, so you know there's a new connection, so you call accept, and it doesn't block, and all that good stuff. So that's how new connections come in. Read events, okay, because so we're only HTTP 1.0 because that 1.1 stuff is too hard. So a connection is only going to be in two states. You're either reading the header or you're writing it back out. Pull-ins on client connections mean, you know, there's more data for us to read in the header. Once we've read it in, we flip the state of the descriptor. Now, when we get pull writes, that means, you know, there's more space for us to send data out. And so as those events come in, we progress the connections like that. Right, so all our network ops are non-blocking. When we get an event, we figure out what state the descriptor's in, and then we start trying to do the work. We try to read the header more, we try to write more data out. And if any of that blocks, we record that back in our descriptor state and fall back to the queue. So we just end up churning only when there's work available. Each threads have their own, this is kind of an interesting aspect. All the threads, as they're their own processes, have their own signal queues. So we can pass event delivery between all the threads and do some really crazy crap with that. It ends up that the only useful use of that is having listening events round robin between threads. Because for locking stuff, you don't want to have events for a descriptor passed around all the threads, because then you could have two threads servicing a descriptor at the same time and it gets really stinky. So we just, after we accept a new connection, we point the listen events at the next thread. And that ends up giving us load distribution as connections come in. There's some grossness here in that we have the SIG IO signal queues coming in are basically edge triggered. We get an event when a state changes. We don't really have a coherent image of the state. We just have a log of state changes in the queue. So there are situations where we could say we had a timeout on the connection. We can be servicing a connection, and we can have events in our queue. If the client disconnects, we'll get a pull hup event at the end of the queue because they hung up. So we'll eventually get to this message that says there's no connection there anymore, and that has a descriptor associated with it. But while we're still back here, we can get a timeout that says we don't care about this connection anymore. So we can close the connection. Somewhere in our queue, we can have a new connection coming in. We'll accept it and get that descriptor we just closed. And then eventually, we'll get further in the queue and get this hup event for the previous one we closed already, but it's for the descriptor we just opened. So we'll end up hanging up on this person, and they'll have no idea what's going on. So we have to get around this. And so I had all these cool data structures. I was throwing FIFOs around and the number of descriptors I have to close and all this cool stuff so that I could tell when I was done with the socket, I'd turn off SIG IO and I'd know how many events were pending. I'd wait for that many to flush before actually closing the descriptor so that it can then be brought in and there's nothing stale in the queue. And I had all these neat, you know, arrays all over the place. It was great. And I was telling Alan about it yesterday and he's like, oh, that's crap. Well, yeah. Of course, I can just toss a signal to myself, pop it on the end of the queue, and say, okay, this descriptor is free. Duh. So now, once I update it, if I care to, when I'm done with the socket, I turn off SIG IO, I send a signal to myself, you know, we churn through all the stuff, and we eventually get a SIG info that says, okay, now close it. And yeah. But my FIFOs were really neat. So there actually is a little duh thing on the slide down there, but it's being eaten. So that was a nasty thing to trip over because I was trying to figure out why these connections were being closed and I was getting nonsensical events and it was a mess. Right, so the resulting server is fast as all get up. While I was at ZD Labs doing the Minecraft stuff, we had, I guess it was a quad P2400 monster ass, you know, 4-way 100 meg. And in their cool lab, they have 1,000 some odd PCs. And we were beating the crap out of this poor machine, and the user CPU was at 1%. I mean, because all the system calls and code paths to get these SIG info structs to user space are really lightweight. You'll walk through TCP, you'll see that an event happened, you look up in the socket, which you already have, the process that owns that, you go right to their process struct and you tack on a signal queue. There's no list walking, there's no locking stuff. It's really lightweight. And then the thread popping it off is similar. I mean, it just has to lock the list, copy it to user space, and return. There's no big nasty things in pull and select I'll get to. So the user space part of this is really quick. It's very nice. It lets the kernel do all the real hard work, you know, protocols and devices and all that junk. Ingo on his quad, whatever the heck it is, with his scheduler and TCP hacks, is getting 3,500 a second over localhost compared to like 12 with the Apache, I think it was. So this event model is really lean. It's not universally applicable, but when you can use it, it goes like smoke. And if you deal with the caveats like the last slide. I implemented PHHTTPD originally with pluggable event models. You could have the SIG IO engine, you could have select. Well, no, you could have pull, and then I looked at select and just puked all over the place and didn't even try. But you could have put select into it. So compared to poll, I was getting about twice as many requests per second, because the poll, so I should touch on this. The select and poll interfaces don't scale. They're showing their age. Select is especially nasty. The basic problem is that they don't record state for the descriptors you care about across system calls. You'll say you have, 10 descriptors you care about, you want to find out events on. You'll fill in the select structure and you'll pass it to the kernel. So we have to copy this big block of data over. The kernel checks them all to see if they're ready and then returns if they are. So we have one copying of this huge mask. We have to walk all the descriptors in it. We have to copy the mask back. Select is especially nasty because the API requires that it steps all over the mask when it returns it, so you get to rebuild it every time, which is neat. And the length of it is bounded not by the number of descriptors you care about, but by the highest numbered descriptor. So you care about one descriptor, it's file descriptor 10,000, and you're passing in a 10K chunk of data to find out about that one descriptor. And the kernel has to walk through 10,000 things to find it. It's less than cool. Poll fixed most of this. It's now just an array of structs, that tell what file descriptors you care about. So you care about three, you have a three wide thing you're tossing back and forth. It doesn't get stepped on, so you don't have to rebuild most of it. But you still have to specify that you're a big web server and you care about 3,000 descriptors, and you do these big copies, and it has to walk the whole thing and copy it back. And that's where the overhead of select and poll come in. They're fine when you have a few, but when you get these web servers that have, 10,000 connections open, it goes to hell really quick. I was doing benchmarking on, I guess it was a single P2. The poll system calls, and the poll functions in the kernel were using half the CPU time with like 200 open connections or something. I mean, and that's compared to doing, full-on TCP work with copy and checksum all over the place. It's not cheap. So the SIGIO stuff fixes that. And so the next slide is what we should put this in. It works really well for non-blocking event engines, like SQUID, THTTP, little web servers, all that stuff. It really doesn't want to block because, you'll have all these events coming in, and if you have to read from disk, which PHTTP just doesn't bother with, but if you have to, you'll be blocking while all these events are queuing up, and that's kind of gross. So that's when you start doing multiple threads and multiple queues and all that to sort of alleviate that pain, but it's there. It's there with select and poll anyway, so you're used to it, I imagine. So it should be plugged into all these little engines. That would be cool. It would be great for a telnet D because all it's doing is passing data between FDs. And Dean's doing some really cool work on Apache 2.0, the MPM stuff. It's a threading abstraction. It's not the nasty APR, NSPR threading Apache model, because that's a hack. This is actually rewriting the response stuff. This is why I'm not as interested in it as it could be. But he's making it so you have a pool of threads waiting, connection comes in, you do the HTTP request decoding, and that's still blocking. So you still have to have as many threads around as there are clients. Yeah, you do. You talk to Dean, man. But, right, so since the protocol parsing is still blocking, you still have that overhead. But once you've decided that this client is going to send back this, huge old MPEG or whatever, it throws it back into a non-blocking response engine that he's using Select for currently, but I could use the SIGIO stuff trivially, and that would be nice. And he has all this cool IO layering stuff, so you can plug in pieces, and it's really nice. He wanted to do the protocol parsing stuff, but it is serious black magic. It would not be trivial. So that's 2.1 stuff. And you can get all that by going to dev.apache.org and checking out the stuff. It's all in there. We want to do an async send file thread, sort of. I guess we're pondering it. And it would actually be more of a thread in the kernel that just does async work, with send file being one of the consumers of it. So currently, a lot of the events you'll get when you're doing this web server are, there's space in the TCP send queues, give me some more data. So we have all these servers just sitting here spinning, filling pipes, which isn't really necessary. So we'd create a thread in the kernel that does this. It would know about, pages it wants to read from disk and connections it wants to send out and all that stuff, and would just have a big engine that does all that. And that would help with the kernel HTTPD stuff, which ends up being more of a proxy thing than anything else. But it would make it so a lot of I/O work would be not exposed to user space anymore. With this, we could have real async I/O in the kernel rather than the pthreads hack. But it would be nice. So we're working on it. It's based around Steven's KIO buff work, which is a new kernel data structure that'll let us do. It lets us sort of make I/O transactions opaque. The owner of the data is encoded in the KIO buff, and the people actually dealing with it don't care who owns it. They just do their work with it and then free it, and the owner does the appropriate magic. So that'll make it so user space can give KIO buffs for, you know, mmapped PCI space, and you can do DMA from user space to PCI and all this crazy crap. But it'll let us do the async stuff. Shared signal queues would be nice, because as I mentioned, if you had all these threads reading one queue, if one of them blocked, the others would pick up the slack, and you wouldn't have connections getting jittery and such. It would be cool. There's locking stuff there, but it's doable. Pthreads would also be very happy about this, because right now it has this signal thread where signals come in and it has to dispatch it, and there's like 5 context switches for a signal delivery in Pthreads. There's something outrageous. So having shared signal queues would clean that up a lot. That's places this should go, I guess. And so if you want them, they are. HFTPD is actually usable unless you're on an SMP box, and you can only use glibc 2.1 and all sorts of good stuff, but it goes. PHHTTPD is mostly a curiosity. I mean, you could use it, you could have real web servers point images at it or something, but I wouldn't rely on it. It's cute, but it's mostly just to showcase the model. So, questions? Yeah. Not too bad. It only holds the kernel lock when it's doing the initial page table stuff. So it will, when it schedules, it releases the lock. So it's only when you call send file and it grabs the lock, it only holds it for as much data as in the cache and can be put directly in the queue. So once the queue is full, once it has to read from disk, it releases the lock and you're okay. So that didn't show up on the profile. The stuff that was bad was the socket locking stuff, you know, that we're now all aware of because of the Minecraft silliness. Not that it's Minecraft's fault. Bruce is a good guy, but Microsoft isn't. Right, yes. So, and that's now fixed. Ingo in 2.3, once I pointed out the lock kernel there, and got rid of it and had it use the new page cache and everything. So, send file, you can now have multiple people in it at once. Other stuff? Do I have, like, hours left? Probably do. Yeah. Breeze through it. There's cool stuff we could talk about. There's the zero copy stuff. There's the VIA stuff. There's all sorts of neat stuff. Talk about zero copy? Yeah. People care about zero copy?
It's pretty cool.
Cool stuff. So, you familiar with the concept? The TCP sometimes can be limited by getting the data from the source to the network card. So, say you're doing, userland's doing a write, we'll copy it from user space into the socket queues, and the hardware will eventually DMA from that copied piece. Or if you do it with send file, the socket layer will copy it from the page cache into the socket and will eventually DMA it out. And that memory copy starts to show up on profiles. If I'm doing, with the 2.3 kernels now that they have unlocked sockets and everything, kernel profiling has copy and checksum way up there. It's a non-trivial amount of CPU. So the trick is to do all the memory stuff by reference. So say, you know, send file, we'll have some pages it wants to send out to a socket. Rather than copying them into a nice buffer for the hardware to DMA, it'll copy references. It'll lock down the pages and say, okay, Mr. Socket Layer, I want these to go out, and the socket layer will record pointers, and the hardware will DMA it from the pages directly rather than through a copy. It's not trivial work, obviously, because we have to do bookkeeping of pages, and we have to have fragmentation and transmission, and all this stuff actually work. So we're just leaving it in Dave's lap. When he does it, it'll work. Until then, it's like, this is spurred by hardware now that can actually do hardware checksumming, because you have to walk over the data to make the TCP checksum, right? But there's hardware now that'll do that for you. There's in the 100 meg LAN, there's the 905B, there's the Adaptec Starfire. I think those are the only 200 megs. Now the Sun HME can sort of do it, but it's limited. And then there's all the gigabit and HIPPE and real network stuff that can do it. But we now have this hardware that could do it. It could cut down our TCP times a lot for bulk data. For small pieces, the latency of copying the data into the FIFO and checksumming it before it gets transmitted is kind of gross. And then there's the expensive code paths of doing all the reference counting. And if you're sending out 2 bytes of data, you know, the pointers are 4 bytes, and you've now wasted time. So you have to have heuristics for when to do all this. And again, it's the KIO buff stuff that'll let us do this, because SendFile will build a KIO buff that says, you know, these many pages and here's the regions of them, and they'll hand the KIO buffs to TCP, and TCP will hand them to the card. Well, the driver will understand KIO buffs, and it'll build hardware-specific lists of pages to DMA out. In the 905B, it's clean, and all of them, they're clean except the HME, which can only have so many pages pending to be DMA'd out, so you have to do some magic, but again, it's waiting on the KIO buff stuff, which Steven is going to solidify darn soon here.
I guess.
Oh, it's worth mentioning that zero copy is only feasible in the near term from stuff that isn't in user space, that can't be swapped. If we're coming from the page cache, we can lock it down, no problem. If we have a user that called write, so the source of the data is in user space, it's really gross to try and believe them. You know, we can't just reference their pages because they can get swapped out. Other threads can unmap it. They can touch it as it's being messed with, but they can do that currently. So that's just grody. We won't let them do that anytime soon. We're not going to do page flipping tricks and, you know, mark it not writable as we're DMAing it. So if they try to write to it, we fault it somewhere else, and ugh, it's just gross. So that won't happen soon. It might eventually. There's also zero copy receive is an even bigger disaster that I'm not touching, and we'll let Yes do it. But it's because you don't know where the data is going to go. It could be out of order. It could not be page aligned. It could, it's just yucky. So, I mean, SGI has, you know, magical socket bits you could set so that the program has to be aware of it happening, and they have to align data properly and, you know, do that mess. So that isn't clean, and we won't do that anytime soon, I'm sure. There's also other people that could really benefit from the zero copy stuff, like KINFSD. It could, you know, now build these transactions with KIO buffs right in and out of the page cache, because that's all kernel space. So we could make NFS go really quick if we could get SunRPC speaking zero copy and KIO buffs, which is certainly pending. Others, did I have too much crack for breakfast this morning?
Yeah.
Happens. Questions? Hoser? Oh. Hoser's not. Oh my goodness. It's maintainable as long as the glibc doesn't change and you don't want to run it anywhere else. Hoser was kind of a learning experience, I guess. It works, but it was kind of a brute force attempt, I guess. The LS code's cool and could be used. A lot of the client abstraction stuff is neat, but the threading semantics are gross. The allocator needs to go. All that stuff. It just the really specific interactions it does with glibc are nasty. I mean, there are parts. So, you know, we have this thread allocator, right? And when a thread exits, we free all the memory it allocated. That's all well and dandy, except that there are things within glibc where the first time you call it, it'll allocate stuff internally to be cached by other people calling into glibc. So the first person into git time of day allocates a cached time zone entry. That thread leaves. Another thread comes in, and glibc has a cache pointer for this allocated cache that has now been freed and explodes all over the place. So there's, honest to God, a function in HFTPD that, in the main process that'll never exit, that just calls all this random glibc junk to do all this cache stuff. It's highly gross. And that's one of the nasty pieces of not cooperating with glibc's locking. And well, there's the, just sort of looking at the problem from a higher level, right? I mean, like the LS thing. You spend all this work writing your internal LS implementation, but, I mean, just cache it, right? It's stuff like that. And actually having IO abstractions in the server that let you use whatever's appropriate for the OS would be cool, but people don't want to do that work. The Apache guys have done really well there. They have their own non-blocking and blocking IO APIs that are actually useful. The point is, I guess, paying attention to, at least what I've learned, is the blocking and non-blocking stuff is highly important. If we had an IO engine that had nice APIs for passing around IO events and everything, we could have a web server module, an FTP module, all this good stuff, and it would just work. But instead, we have all these different code bases doing basically the same thing. But, I mean, the lesson, the SIGIO stuff is actually cool. As far as I know, I'm the only person using this stuff. According to Steven, he was excited as all anything to see someone actually using this, and there were some bugs in it, but I hope that actually starts being used because it's a much cleaner event model. Actually, some interesting related work in this, The, I wish I could remember the name of it, the BSD hack that Apple's put out, the kernel, they call it something else. Anyway, they fixed NFS, they did some stuff, but one of the things they did was adding an actual user space event API. So they have stuff similar to the SIGIO event delivery, but it's a whole new API where you can register. You might even be able to do that exciting thing you like, completion ports. You can sort of do completion ports with it. You can spawn off threads in a function when an event comes in and all this messy stuff. Sort of. They've abstracted the event model. And the BSD guys are actually looking at it, but they want to do it right. And I was pointing them at this stuff. And there was a paper in Usenix 2 years ago on select and poll replacements with event queuing and all this stuff. So people are working on it, but it's not as high a priority. The Zeus guys, I expect, will start using this pretty quick because a lot of their stuff, from what I can tell, is select and pull and sensible non-blocking engines. Yes?
So what is the status of all this stuff that you currently have to be talking about? How much of it exists? How much of it is in existing kernels, and how much of it is going to future kernels?
All of it's in, well, okay, the SIGIO stuff isn't in yet. The signal queuing is, the SIGIO events aren't. That's a patch that Stephen is actually getting in 2.3 in the next few days. I don't know if it'll go in 2.2. It probably will. It's trivial. But the rest of it's all there. I mean, the only kernel patch in any of this is adding the SIGIO stuff to the kernel and fixing some signal allocation bugs, but that's not related. The TCP zero copy stuff is much more fun, is probably 2.5 work, unless Dave gets motivated and does it on a Wednesday or something. But it's a lot of changes. You have to have different code paths for classic SKBs and now these KIO buff ones, and so that's down the road. Others? I've thought about it. I'd really like to do the IO event engine thing where you have abstractions for pulling in new connections and accepting new connections and all this stuff. So you can use like, you know, Solaris's zero copy stuff, and all these different IO models and all these different OSs could be abstracted in this one core. You can hang things off it. And that I've thought about doing it. And fixing Hoser would be not too bad. I mean, it works on Linux now. And it could be made to work on NetBSD without too much trouble. But it's sort of end of life at this point for me, because I'm not paid to hack on it, and it's getting icky. But doing the event model thing would be fun, but it's kind of duplicated code, sort of, because it's in Apache, but the Apache stuff is really web-specific, and so, I don't know, I'm pondering it. I would have to get a few more people interested so we could all churn on it, because it's a big project. But it would be neat, because you could then have, you know, all sorts of cool Corba hooks and XML config, and oh man, you could go to town. You have this big IO monster, but... It's not a weekend hack, which PHHTTPD was. Other stuff? Is that like, what, 15, 20 minutes? Yeah, okay, I guess we're done then. We're out of here.